MechCast, Friday, July 21st, 2017. Hey, MechGeeks, it's time for your MechCast, the show for MechGeeks by MechGeeks. I'm Adam, and this is the show where we discuss all things Macintosh. How you doing? Welcome back to the MechCast. Well, glad to be back here with you after my vacation. Sorry it's been a little longer between shows, but I was out of town camping. So not a lot of internet, not a lot of access to do my research. Luckily for us, I don't think there's been too much going on. I'm looking over the show notes for today. We've got a few things to talk about, more concerns about the iPhone 8 launch. We'll talk about what's going on there, but you can probably imagine a little bit of information on Mac sales and how Apple is doing there. We're also going to get into Apple releasing some information about its machine learning efforts in a new way that's a little bit different, and also some pitches happening on Apple TV and TV concepts, and Apple maybe partnering with somebody on some electric vehicle stuff. Yeah, that's a little bit interesting. So we'll get into that. We also have some questions and feedback from you. I'm going to talk a little bit about my thoughts on ARKit. We have a guy who actually upgraded an iMac. We'll talk about that a little bit. And also questions about KTEXT files, and also we comment on the Mac Pro and what might be going on and happening there. So it should be a pretty good show. Should be fun to get into. Like I said, I'm glad to be back, even though it is getting pretty hot here down in San Diego. We had a pretty mild July, and now here in August, things are warming up. So the studio is getting hot, but maybe that's a good thing. We'll just keep the heat going and keep talking. I don't know what I'm talking about. I'm just making up stuff. That's what I do around here on the MechCast. Either way, some good things to jump into. So let's just dive right into it. Starting off with iPhone 8 launch concerns. You know, we've been talking about this for a while. Apple seems to be struggling, at least if the supply chain is to be believed, struggling with getting component parts and everything they need lined up for producing the next iPhone, the iPhone 8, iPhone Edition, whatever we're going to be calling this thing. It is the new, all redesigned iPhone. There's huge pent-up demand for it, and it's seeming like supplies are going to be in limited quantities. Fast Company ran a report this week citing sources who claimed Apple is having issues with the wireless charging software now. One of the rumored features is that the new iPhone will feature wireless charging, and it's not the hardware that seems to be the problem. It may be the software, at least when it comes to the wireless stuff. So much so that in the report, they say there's a panic, quote unquote, setting in around Apple. Somehow I find that a little bit hard to believe. It is believed that Apple is using the Qi wireless standard. QI is how that's spelt out. So if you've seen it written out in blogs, it's Qi wireless or some sort of variant of it. They actually use a variant of that technology in the Apple Watch with its wireless charging system, but it is still Apple proprietary. So the hardware is a little bit tweaked, software is a little bit tweaked, and that may be what's going on here. So the hardware is not the problem, the software is. The report says it might be so bad that Apple could be considering disabling the feature entirely at launch and turning it on later when they can get their software problems sorted out. And that would not be the end of the world. We've seen Apple do this before, actually with the last iPhone launch. You remember the iPhone 7 Plus had that really cool portrait camera mode feature, and that was not enabled at launch. So people bought it and they turned it on a little bit later. And, you know, as far as Apple having accessories for it, it's not clear if they're going to do third-party accessories. So, you know, it wouldn't be the end of the world. You can still plug it in with a lightning cable and charge it. I don't think that's a real deal breaker or stopper for the release of the iPhone 8. So the fact that they're saying panic is setting in, that may be a little bit extreme. I don't think Apple engineers and Apple ever really gets panicked. I think they plan for these sorts of things. They have plan A's and B's and C's all the way probably through Z. And it may be rough for them, but I think they're going to weather it just fine. A Bloomberg report also cites sources that say the new 3D sensors that are rumored to be possibly driving the new 3D facial recognition system that might be in the iPhone 8 are also giving Apple some grief. The Fast Company piece also seemed to support that, saying that their source claims Apple engineers are having trouble getting the sensors to work reliably. The source wouldn't comment on what exactly the sensors are for, but we've heard reports that the new iPhone could use facial recognition instead of Touch ID. And if that's true, I would imagine problems with the 3D sensors and not having them work perfectly would be somewhat of a concern at this point, this late stage in the game. Still, the Fast Company source also seems to think that there's still a good chance the Touch ID sensor will still be on the iPhone 8 integrated into the display. That's a rumor that's been in dispute. We've heard, oh, it may be integrated. Apple's having trouble with that. It's not going to be integrated. It may be on the back. They may get rid of it altogether and only go with 3D facial recognition. Who really knows at this point? My personal opinion, and I've talked about this a little bit, is that Apple has too much riding on the Touch ID sensor. It deals with the banks. Apple Pay relies upon it. It is a great technology. It works really well. It's fast and reliable, very secure. And I don't think they're going to supplant it just with 3D facial recognition unless they can prove somehow that the 3D facial recognition is a better system. And the fact that to use Apple Pay, you have to sort of tap your phone, usually down on a reader, usually at an odd angle. I just don't see how 3D facial recognition is going to work for that. And the idea that I'd have to hold it to my face and then hold it to a sensor just adds an extra step. It seems like not a good user experience. So it could be their, you know, plan Z if they can't get anything else working in terms of Touch ID sensor, but I really don't think that's what's going to be on. And finally, as the piece points out, with Apple, nothing is set in stone until they announce it. And they even go into late changes with designs and technologies that are in phones, even late in the production cycle. So even though we're kind of mid-summer now, moving toward the end of summer when Apple should be sort of finishing everything up, it's not entirely unheard of to hear that they make a few little tweaks here and there. So there's that going on. Another supply chain that Apple seems to be dealing with, at least according to the Korea Herald, they reported that Apple had purchased, quote, tens of millions of dollars worth of rigid, flexible printed circuit board equipment to help their suppliers keep up with the iPhone production. Supposedly, this came about when one of Apple's suppliers backed out of a deal, leaving Apple with only two Korean companies, Interflex and Yongpung Electronics, to produce the boards that they needed. So Apple's buying some additional equipment from them. They are reportedly leasing the equipment to these suppliers, and that's to make sure that they are able to keep up production and stay on track for the launch. So ultimately, you know, should we be panicked? I guess is the question. Is this going to be a problem for Apple, for consumers who want to buy iPhones on day one? I will say this. If you want to buy an iPhone 8, iPhone Edition, whatever it might be, on the first day of launch, well, one, iPhone is always constrained early on, but this will be a problem this time around. One analyst is predicting that 40% of the current iPhone installed base, that's more than 700 million customers, currently have phones that are greater than 2 years old. That means you have 700 million customers who are potential upgraders. They're at the cycle when typically someone is going to upgrade their iPhone. Will they all? No, but that is a lot of customers. That's more than we saw back in 2014, I think, with the iPhone 6. Was that iPhone 6 launch? I'm trying to remember my history. Point is, it's going to be constrained. I predict, you know, my prediction, and I'm just speculating at this point, is that back orders are going to start slipping to later in the year within hours of the iPhone 8 going on sale. And eventually, within probably weeks to a month, they're probably going to fall into iPhones delivering in 2018. So not even getting out the door this year, at least according to Apple's estimates. Now, that said, Apple has always historically been pretty good about ramping up the production cycle even after launch and starting to beat expectations on order dates. And they should catch up fairly quickly, probably before the end of the year. So they're usually able to get the supply chain sorted out. Even if it's not great day one, they can usually get it sorted out before the end of the year. And ultimately for Apple, you know, so for consumers, yes, it's going to be a little bit of a pain, especially if you're an Apple fan like we all are and we want our iPhones right when they come out. It is going to be a problem for us. For the rest of the world, your average consumer, not so much an issue. And for Apple, really the high demand has always been really good on the marketing side of things. When people see, oh my gosh, there's a frenzy for the new iPhone, everybody suddenly wants it. And it just feeds into the demand. It generally doesn't impact the stock market or Apple stock price too much. They will take a beating in the press. They're going to have a field day with that. But to be honest, the press would have a bigger field day if Apple didn't get the iPhone out this year. If they decided to wait for supply chain to get sorted out and delayed the launch into later in the year or even into next year, that would be a bigger PR nightmare for Apple than just having not enough stock on launch day. So ultimately, they could take a small hit in the quarterly numbers that could minimally affect the stock price, but they're going to bounce right back from it. And all indications are that the iPhone 8 is going to be a huge, huge seller. So I think net, it's going to be really positive for Apple. Now, the question is Apple going to get an iPhone out before the iPhone 8? This is an interesting little story that came up this week. iGeneration cites a new source for them that claims Apple is planning to have an iPhone launch event next month in August. But it's not going to be for the iPhone 8. They're saying it is a new version of the iPhone SE. Now, I wouldn't put too much stock in this at this point because production would have had to have flown completely under the radar. We've had no rumors about an iPhone SE being in production, and if it was launching next month, we would have very likely heard about it. I think of all the iPhone 8 rumors, and you have a good idea on why I don't think we're going to see an iPhone SE update next month. Still, the source claims that Apple's going to introduce the phone at a reduced starting price, 399 euros versus 489 euros. So that's about a 90 euro price drop, and I would expect a similar one on the US pricing. I'm thinking if there's anything to this rumor at all, it's that Apple might just be planning a price drop for the existing iPhone SE model, nothing more. That would do a lot to boost sales. That's a very popular entry-level model. They wouldn't really have to change anything, and that would sort of line up, I think, with this rumor. We've also had recent reports that Apple could be completely discontinuing the iPhone SE launch, so sort of going the complete other, or the iPhone SE, going completely the other direction, and I think that is unlikely as well. The iPhone SE is a very popular model at this point, and I don't see Apple phasing it out. Again, I don't see them really upgrading it or changing it too much this year, but a price drop, that actually could do very well, especially moving into the end of the year. They could get a lot more iPhone SEs into hands, and that potentially means more iPhone upgrades later down the line. So will the iPhone 8 get here in September? At least one analyst is saying yes. We had heard rumors that it might be delayed until October, but again, he's saying limited quantities. JP Morgan analyst Rod Hall thinks that Apple will still launch in September, but they may sell fewer units, 42.2 million units in the September quarter. And that's only slightly down from what they sold in the September quarter last year, which was 45.4 million units. So again, they're probably going to take a little bit of a unit sale hit because of supply constraints, but overall, it's going to be very good for Apple. And pricing-wise, Hall thinks the iPhone 8 is going to come with two models, a 128-gigabyte unit selling for $1,100 US and a 256-gigabyte model selling for $1,200 US. Those prices are a little bit higher than we've heard in the past. I'm hoping they're a little bit higher than we would expect. I was hoping to see a $999, $1,099 kind of price breakdown for those two models, and I think that's better. But again, Apple could push the price up knowing that demand is going to be high and we're still going to ultimately pay it, and that's good for the bottom line. Plus, just the component costs of this phone based on all the new technology is going to be a lot higher for Apple, and they like to maintain their margins. So we could be looking at the most expensive iPhone we have ever seen to date, but again, I really don't think ultimately it's going to affect sales all too much, all that much. And that's kind of the latest on the iPhone 8. The latest numbers from Gartner are in for worldwide PC shipments in the second quarter of 2017, and Apple looks pretty flat year over year, actually down just slightly 0.4% from the second quarter last year, at least in terms of Mac sales. Now, normally this wouldn't be too concerning, except for the fact that Apple has recently updated their Macintosh line. We have new updated MacBook Pros, and we have great brand new iMacs that are out right now. So you would expect sales to be a little bit higher. But despite the slowness of Apple shipments, Their overall share of the worldwide PC market was up just slightly, about 0.2% to 6.9%, almost 7% of the PC market. And that's because a number of the big PC makers like Asus, Acer, and Lenovo saw a much larger year-over-year shipment decline between 8.4 and 12.5%. So Apple staying relatively flat means they're overall staying a bit ahead of the rest of the PC industry. Really, only Dell and HP fared better than Apple in the quarter, and really not by much, just by a couple percent in terms of growth. And overall, I kind of feel like this is a trend that is likely to continue. If Apple can keep shipments and sales at a relatively static level, maybe a little bit of year-over-year growth and not too much decline, I think they're going to be doing very well. And the reason I say that is because I really think that phones and tablets, for a lot of people, are taking over a lot of their basic computing tasks, and now even some advanced ones. I know iPads, especially with the new iPad Pros, they're getting pretty advanced at some of the things that they can do. And I think for people, they're either going with phones and tablets as their primary or only computing device. A number of people, I'm not saying everyone, but also for people like myself, I am supplementing my computing with tablets and phones. So while I will always probably have a notebook or some sort of desktop, my need to upgrade those as frequently has somewhat diminished. So I think this sort of feels like the new norm and not really necessarily a cause for concern. And once again, I think Apple is very smart about reading trends and knowing what's going on. They know that this is happening and they're really not caught off guard with these numbers. Consequently, though, I think along with this change in buying patterns, I think we're going to see longer times between major upgrade cycles of Mac models. So I think we'll see smaller tweaks from time to time in the line, maybe once or twice a year with some processor updates and things like that. But sort of major redesigns or major architectural updates, I'm looking at 18 to 24 months apart with those happening. We've already kind of been seeing this cycle going on. Apple is updating and upgrading Macs less frequently. And I think that only naturally falls and sort of matches along with kind of these sales trends. So I think it all makes sense. Bottom line, though, for us as consumers, if you are in the market for a new Mac and looking to buy one, I think you now, when you're making your buying decision, need to think more for the long term, more for it's going to be a while before the next model that I maybe want to upgrade it to is coming out. So maxing out things like storage and RAM and processor, I think, are more important. It used to be you could kind of maybe get along with the middle of the road and you'd be okay because in a year or two, there's another model you could upgrade to if you really needed it. Now, I think that's not necessarily going to be the case. So more and more, sort of more than ever, I'm going to say buy the most amount of computer that you can at the time that you're purchasing, and that's going to give you sort of that longevity to kind of weather the longer release cycles. So I think that's just what's going on, but interesting to see the numbers sort of backing that up. And good news is that, again, overall, Apple is faring a little bit better than the rest of the PC industry. We had heard that Apple was going to begin to allow their engineers and scientists to talk about their work a little bit more at conferences, specifically the guys working in artificial intelligence and machine learning, and that was kind of something new for Apple. Now it's looking like they've actually created a whole subsite at apple.com for publishing or releasing some of this information. The Apple Machine Learning Journal site at machinelearning.apple.com. I'll have a link to it in the show notes at maccast.com. That's where you can, quote, read posts written by Apple engineers about their work using machine learning technologies. And the first post up there is something entitled Improving the Realism of Synthetic Images. It actually sounds very similar to me and could actually be the same as a paper that was published by Apple engineers last year. I think we talked about it a little bit here on the MacCast, and it discusses using synthetic images versus real ones in the training of neural networks. And the paper says the main advantage of this, well, there's a couple main advantages, but things like a savings in cost and time, because the training requires large and very diverse sets of image data. And one of the big challenges in using real images is that they have to be pre-identified and pre-labeled before you put them into the machine learning system. So you have to know what images you have before you can actually feed them in. And using real images, that means typically you have to use humans to actually identify what these images are so you can feed them to the machine and then, you know, teach it about what the image is and tweak it and stuff like that. And I'm obviously oversimplifying, and anybody who's in machine learning is probably cringing right now, but you get the idea. And Apple is saying if you generate them synthetically, an advantage is that you already know what kind of image you're creating. So if you say, I need images of trees, and you create a program to start generating images of trees or eyeballs or whatever it might be, they're already pre-labeled, they have metadata attached to them, and you can feed that into the system and use all of that data to aid in the neural net in the machine learning. Now, the downside of synthetic images is that they may not be close enough to the real thing to provide a real accurate training. And so what this paper is about is a process that Apple developed, and it explains the process that Apple developed for refining the synthetic images and making them look more realistic. So it goes through this whole process. It's a long piece. If you're really interested in it, I encourage you to visit the Apple's new website and check it out. But basically, it goes into the detail on how Apple developed this refiner technique for synthetic images. And this might start to feel or seem counterintuitive for a company as secret as Apple. You know, they in the past typically would not disclose this kind of stuff because it really gives some insight into the kinds of technologies and the things that Apple might be working on. But what has happened is that Apple was finding reportedly that it was very hard to get top researchers in these fields to come work at Apple if they were not going to be allowed to speak or publish information about their research. So Apple is opening it up, at least on this side of the company, in terms of the secrecy. And I think it's a compromise. Could it hurt Apple? Maybe a little bit, but I think ultimately it's a really good one because they're going to be able to recruit and get in some of the top technology experts in the world in these fields. And I think that's ultimately very important. And we're going to be talking a little bit later about ARKit. And I think that's a big reason why Apple kind of has a leg up on that technology. But check out the new machine learning blog. There's only the one post there right now. It'll be interesting to see how frequently Apple actually updates that. Both Variety and CNBC are reporting that Jeffrey Katzenberg, one of the founders of DreamWorks, has been running around talking to different companies, including Apple, and trying to pitch them on a new TV service called, surprisingly, get this, New TV. The idea is he wants to create kind of a TV service or network that would create content using well-known talent, and they would produce short 10-minute kind of episodes or segments. The idea, I assume, is to try to begin to capitalize on the younger 18 to 34 audience who seems to prefer services like YouTube or Instagram or Periscope, those sorts of things, to get their entertainment versus broadcast TV. So trying to appeal to them. The report says they might also try to work in things like a 5-minute talk show or 2-minute newscasts. So really brief, short, but highly produced, high quality bits of content with well-known, I'm assuming, celebrities and talented producers and directors and those sorts of people. The report says the content would come without ads, but would actually be supported by integrating branding, so I'm assuming product placement, and also title sponsors. So, you know, this show brought to you by insert name of advertiser here. They also say that there could be a free tier that would include more traditional kinds of advertising, it sounds like, but you know, ultimately the idea is you'd subscribe to the service and you would get this content sort of ad-free, or at least free of ads inside the content beyond some product placement. Yeah, I don't know. Doesn't sound all that great to me either, but again, I think I'm maybe, well, I know I'm not the target market because I'm older than 34. Anyway, the idea, the problem with it may be, though, that it has a pretty high price tag. He's looking at looking for a company to spend about $2 billion to invest in the endeavor. And he's supposedly pitching to the idea not only to Apple, but also to companies like Google, AT&T, Verizon, T-Mobile, Snapchat, and Spotify. You know, I like this idea on one level, but to me, it also feels like Hollywood just trying to break in and get into a format that really already exists. There's a lot of very popular YouTube shows and YouTube stars, and there's a whole ecosystem building up there of a lot of great indie content. Of course, Katzenberg's vision is that that content is quote-unquote not professional or it's amateurish. I think that's wrong. I think there's a lot of great high-quality content being produced in both video podcasts and on YouTube and online with indie developers. And they're making good quality stuff. And I think this is just a case of Hollywood sees this is where the audience is going, and they're going to try and follow it, and they're going to try and use their weight and their money to bust and break into those things. So will Apple be a part of that? Who knows? I think Apple's already trying to build some of that on their own with some of their video efforts through Apple Music. So I'm not really convinced they would need somebody like Katzenberg or this idea. I think they've already kind of tapped into that. And being early big supporters of podcasters, I think, plays into that as well. So it'll be interesting to see what happens here. But, you know, again, this could be another thing that plays into Apple's future Apple TV and media efforts. So we'll kind of keep an eye on it and watch it. But I don't expect this to show up at Apple. It seems something more ripe for someone like a Verizon or a Snapchat or maybe a Spotify. Finally, in the news for this week, a Shanghai-based site claims that Apple has signed a secret agreement working with a Chinese battery manufacturer, Contemporary Amperex Technology Limited, on automotive battery research and development. They did not give a lot of specifics, but they say the two companies have signed a confidentiality agreement to work together on a scheme related to the field of batteries. Now, CATL is a leader in lithium-ion battery research and development in China, and that includes development of battery cells, materials, and recycling. And they also claim to be the world's third largest manufacturer of hybrid and electric vehicle batteries behind BYD and Panasonic. I think those two companies, at least Panasonic, I believe, supplies some batteries to Tesla. And of course, Tesla is a big player in this market now with their new battery factory out in the desert there. What do they call it? The Gigafactory. But Apple had, you know, as you know, reportedly shut down their rumored autonomous electric vehicle project and has been focusing on what they've been calling autonomous systems. So it seems a little bit odd that they would need to partner with an electrical vehicle battery manufacturer. And so why they're doing this is obviously up and ripe for speculation, which is certainly happening. You know my theory. I still believe that as much as Apple is building an autonomous vehicle system, I do think ultimately where that is going to land is in some sort of car service. So car as a service kind of technology, and whether Apple builds their own vehicles for that or they partner with someone else to build those vehicles, I'm not really sure. I would think it would be more a partnership arrangement, but if they do want to build their own vehicles, they're going to need battery technology. And so they're going to want to get in early with companies like this. It's also possible that these guys are just helping Apple build better batteries or develop better battery technology for their existing products. Apple uses batteries in a lot of places, laptops, cell phones, iPads, Apple Watches. So it could be more about that kind of thing than just cars. You know, it's just this company also works in that field. I would imagine their research and their efforts are not limited solely to electric vehicles, though. Now, the company did also show off, though, a battery technology last year that could bring an electric vehicle battery up to a 90% charge in just 15 minutes. So they have some rapid charging technology there, and that would be great, again, for an electric car service if that's where Apple is going, or it'd be great in my laptop. If I could plug my laptop in and get it charged up to 90% in 15 minutes, I'd be all for that. So that could be where Apple's going with this. Who really knows? And again, this is all secretive and speculative, so it may not be happening at all, but I think it's very likely. Apple has a vested interest in battery technologies. But with that, that is going to do it for the news for this week. Now, moving on, I want to talk a little bit about ARKit. Are you getting as excited about Apple's ARKit as I am? I am shocked more than anybody about this. I was not expected to be this excited about augmented reality. Apple had been talking about it. Tim Cook said he believes this is one of the major new technologies that Apple has been investing in moving forward. Apple's been very interested in it for a while. They've been doing a lot of acquisitions. We've talked about a lot of those here on the MacCast, various companies like Mateo and a lot of vision and machine learning companies. And I have to say, after seeing the demo of ARKit that Apple showed off at Worldwide Developer Conference, and now even more seeing all of the demo applications and sort of the experiments and things like that the developers, now that they have it in their hands, are putting together, I am pretty excited. And I think this technology may put Apple farther ahead in the lead of augmented reality than most, if not all, of their competitors. I really believe it may be the biggest technological advancement that Apple has put out in years, probably the last 5 years, more so than a lot of their products and some of the other things that they've been doing. And they've been doing some amazing things. So that's not a small statement in my mind. And, you know, the kinds of demo applications that we are seeing are amazing. You've got overlays inside virtual environments. You've got applications for navigation systems. The gaming applications are turning out to be just amazing, although those really are the ones that sort of least interest me. I mean, it's kind of cool that, you know, I can overlay my 3D world on top of the table in my living room, and it's kind of fun, but it really just at the end of the day feels a little bit gimmicky. Now, there have been some game demos that have been sort of put out where you actually walk around kind of an AR virtual environment and interact with elements that are actually in the physical world, more like Pokemon Go style. And that seems like a more interesting game application to me than just sort of laying something out on my tabletop and just letting me sort of play it virtually. But still, amazing technology, and the ease and of how you can do that, and you can do surface detection and the physics of that. That is the magic of ARKit. That's what Apple is delivering to developers: the ease of developing this stuff without having to put in a lot of effort into the underlying technologies. And what's great about that is that allows the developers to step back and really focus on the application, the user experience, and what to do with the technology, rather than having to get mired in implementing the underlying technologies themselves. So another great application for augmented reality is like tech support and how-tos, you know, being able to have an app that might overlay on top of your car engine when you're trying to work on a certain part or replace a part or something like that, and can show you exactly where to go step by step with overlays on, okay, you need to remove this wire and here's how you remove it. And even for like working on technology, imagine a whole iFixit kind of thing. The next time you need to swap out a hard drive in your MacBook Pro and you use an augmented reality app on your iPad to actually walk you through step by step how to do it, so you don't pull the wrong wire. You know, sometimes it can be confusing. It's hard to see which is the thing that I'm actually going after. And those kinds of things we are seeing now. And in the past, it's always been kind of the promise of this, but you haven't really been seeing it implemented. And I will link to a video in the show notes at maccast.com, or just go on Google and search for YouTube rather, and search for ARKit demos, and you will find some really amazing things. I mean, I saw a demo this week that was showing turn-by-turn directions that were overlaid on the real world. So you want to know how to get to Starbucks? You type in Starbucks, and then up pop lines and arrows right on the environment in front of you, showing you, okay, turn at this corner, turn at the next corner. Really pretty amazing. The ARKit is so accurate, you can actually have measurements, real accurate, real-world measurements. So there was a great app demo that was showing getting the square footage of a room by actually drawing lines on the screen point to point around your room and getting actual accurate measurements. Gaming and entertainment applications, I think, are just endless, and developers are going crazy over this technology. And I think that's the real win and the real success of ARKit, is that developers are super excited about building applications using this technology and are able to implement it in a real rapid and easy way. And that is going to make for some amazing stuff. So I think we're in for a whole ARKit app revolution coming up, and we're just at the tip of the iceberg, and I'm so excited about seeing where it's going. And for developers, I think a lot of the hype and a lot of the excitement is because they now have something that there's going to be a platform for on day one. Many existing devices are going to support this technology, and again, that's huge. It's a huge advantage for iOS developers. They don't have to wait for people to get new hardware or new technology. They can just build an app and they get millions of potential customers on day one. That means you're going to have more companies interested in developing AR applications for the iPhone and for iOS than other platforms. And that is a big deal. This is what we saw with the whole app revolution, you know. So I think we're going to go through a sort of second generation app revolution around augmented reality applications. And Apple also has the advantage that they can optimize the software for their hardware. That means the experiences are going to be fast. They're going to be very capable experiences on existing devices. Developers know that it's going to work, that everybody's going to have a good experience. Right now, ARKit is going to work if you have an iPhone SE, an iPhone 6S or better, and a 2016 or newer iPad or iPad Pro. So all of those models are going to be able to support ARKit applications on day one. And then new devices, they're going to have technology that make the experience even better. We talked about Apple and the next generation iPhones integrating new 3D and laser sensors. That's going to do more depth mapping, more 3D mapping, spatial mapping with the iPhone 8. And that's only going to enhance and make better augmented reality experiences. And the iPhone is going to have also some of the most advanced imaging and optical sensors of any smartphone on the market. And that's going to be huge benefits, not only to augmented reality, but also just to the photography systems that are in the iPhone. And the iPhone, I think, is already one of the best smartphone cameras out there. And this is only going to take it to a whole new level. So just overall, if you can't tell, I'm super excited about ARKit. And I'd love to know what you think. Are you seeing these demos and stuff like that? Are you getting as excited about this technology as I am? I think it is going to be really game-changing and potentially life-changing in a lot of areas. And I'm just excited to see what apps and things actually hit the market. So I think this all comes to a head when, you know, iOS 11 is finally released sometime this fall, and it's going to be just fun to see. It's a really kind of interesting and great time to be an iOS fan, I think. So the other thing I want to talk to you about is an interesting video I saw on YouTube this week. There was a guy, and I will link to the YouTube video in the show notes at MacCast.com, but a YouTuber, Quinn Nelson, and he was very impressed by Apple's new iMac updates, but not all that impressed by the $5,300 US price tag for a new fully loaded 27-inch iMac. And so he looked at that, and he kind of took it as a challenge to see if he could get that same configuration, but save some money. And you might be thinking, well, how are you going to do that? And, you know, Apple's really the only place you can buy an iMac from, and you can buy it pre-configured, and that's sort of about it. Well, he decided he was going to see if he could take a base model 27-inch iMac and upgrade it to match as close as possible the specs of the fully loaded 27-inch iMac and see what that would cost. So he started with a base model 27-inch. He did upgrade the internal Fusion drive to a 500 gigabyte SSD. So the base price model, he spent $1,800 US for. And the main idea behind that was he could have a built-in drive. Apple's drives, SSDs are fully optimized for their architecture. So they're super fast. And so that gives you the ability to have the super fast boot drive. So he did that. And then what he did was he bought all the other components and parts he needed to sort of soup it up. So he bought an Intel i7 7700K CPU. He purchased a 2 terabyte Crucial MX300 SSD drive, a 2.5 inch internal SSD, 64 gigabytes of RAM. That was actually the easiest thing to upgrade because the 27 inch iMac just has a RAM door. So there wasn't a lot of effort involved there. It was just buying more RAM, but buying it third party allowed him to save some cash versus what Apple charges for their RAM. Now, we could have the debate, you know, Apple RAM is actually pretty good, high quality RAM, and not all RAM is created equal, but we'll just let that go for this one. He did max it out. Then he also needed an OWC thermal sensor for the SSD because Apple requires that. If you don't have a thermal sensor on the SSD inside an iMac, what'll happen is you can put one in, but the fans will run at 100%. They will think the machine is always overheating. So you got to get that thermal sensor. Actually, a pretty expensive component from OWC. It's about $40. And then, of course, you need an adhesive screen kit because when you open up the Mac, you break the iMac, you have to break the adhesive seal on the front glass. So you got to put that back in place. That's not too expensive. And then because the internal hard drive, the internal SSD is a 2.5 inch, and typically the hard drive space inside the iMac, the mounting screws and stuff is set up for a 3.5 inch drive, you have to get an adapter. So needed an adapter for that. And then finally, if you order an iMac with an SSD built in, you need an Apple data and power cable. There's a special cable that you need to, a proprietary cable, to attach the SSD to the motherboard connector. So you have to get that. Luckily, those can kind of be found online or on eBay, and they're not too expensive, so you can pick one of those up. So after getting all the parts he needed, and with the original $1,800 cost of the base level iMac, his total cost for the entire machine, $3,471 US. So that's about $1,800 less, a whole nother base model iMac less in terms of cost. Now, of course, there's the caveats, right? So while you can do this, one, you're going to open up the iMac and you're going to immediately break the warranty. You need kind of some special tools, to break that seal. You need the best tool probably to get is the one from iFixit. It's a little sort of pizza wheel tool that allows you to break the seal on the display without damaging because there's some cables relatively close to that edge. So if you try and use like a knife or guitar picks or whatever it might be, you run the risk of going too deep and maybe nicking or potentially damaging some of those cables. So you got to deal with that. And you're going to have to completely disassemble the Mac to get to the processor. So that includes doing things like removing the speakers, taking out the fan, getting to the motherboard. You have to remove the old CPU, clean off all of the thermal cooling paste and all that sort of stuff, put new paste on, put the new CPU in, put it all back together. He claims the whole upgrade process took him about an hour. I have to imagine it would take a little bit longer for most of us. But the point is it can be done. You can upgrade if you're really into it. You can really upgrade the CPU in your iMac. And it looks like after all was said and done, his Geekbench scores showed that his Mac was actually about 8% faster than the Geekbench scores of Apple's top-of-the-line model. Now, you may be saying to yourself, well, Adam, there's one other major difference, and you would be right, and that is the GPU. If you buy the base model iMac, you get a Radeon Pro 570 with 4 gigabytes of VRAM. The top-of-the-line model has a Radeon Pro 580 with 8 gigabytes of VRAM. So you get double the VRAM and a little bit better GPU, but it's not that huge of a difference. And in the video, he claims that his Final Cut Pro tests showed that the modded Mac that he had with the lower end Radeon GPU were actually 5% better than the benchmark scores for Final Cut Pro tests with the top of the line iMac stocked from Apple. Whether that's accurate or not, I really don't know. Again, this is one YouTube video, so take that with a grain of salt, but that's what he claims to have achieved, which seems to indicate that Final Cut is doing a lot more with the CPU rather than the GPU, which is interesting. I would think Apple would want to rely more on the GPU, but it may be the case that they don't use super high-end GPUs in the iMac, so they fall back on to the processor. But needless to say, it's an interesting way to get a cheaper top-of-the-line iMac. And while we're talking here a little bit about the Macs and new Macs, we should probably comment a little bit, or I want to comment a little bit, I guess, on the Mac Pro, because I received a voicemail from listener Tim, and he had some theories about the new Mac Pro, and I wanted you to hear them, and also I wanted to comment on them. So here's what Tim had to say.
Hi, Adam. This is Tim from Virginia. So I have some food for thought for you on the upcoming Mac Pro. And that is that we, you know, Apple's kind of told us that it's supposed to be modular. And so I'm thinking that where they're headed is that they're going to rename the Mac Mini the Mac, and then the Mac Pro will still be the Mac Pro. But they're going to be, I wouldn't be surprised if they're kind of one and the same, in the sense that you can, the Mac, what we call the Mac Mini now, you could buy just that, and you would have a Mac Mini, although they would call it the Mac. But if you needed something more pro-ish, then you start, the modularity starts coming into play, where you can, you know, either plug the computer itself into some sort of base that allows you to have hard drives in it, or you plug in external hard drives, external hard drive units. And I think at WWDC this year, they highlighted the ability to plug in an external video card box into your computer so that you no longer have to have, you know, the big mammoth video card inside of your computer. It can actually exist externally. So if that's what you need, then that's what you get. So that's the modularity. And then if you look at their computer lines right now, you see there's a MacBook, and then there's a MacBook Pro. And then there's the iMac, and now coming is the iMac Pro. So I'm just thinking there's going to be Mac, and then there's going to be Mac Pro. And the Mac and the Mac Pro, again, will be similar, like the iMac and the iMac Pro are in terms of form factor. But obviously the Mac Pro, you know, is probably going to have, you know, Xeon processors or whatever high-end workstation processors in it. And maybe, you know, you'll have the ability to put in, you know, gobs of RAM in there where you wouldn't in the straight Mac. But I think in terms of form factor, I think they'll look, the base units will look identical. So, and they haven't done anything, they haven't replaced the Mac Mini yet, have they? So they said that they value that machine, but I think they haven't come out with a replacement, because the replacement for that is going to look awfully similar to the replacement for the Mac Pro. So anyway, that's what I'm thinking. Keep up the good work. Bye.
Hey, Tim, thanks for the feedback. You got some interesting thoughts there. There are things that I've kind of heard before, and I'm kind of, I think, in agreement with you on some things, and probably differ from you a little bit on some others. The form factor, I'm not so convinced about. It's an interesting idea to think that Apple would make some sort of squarish, maybe tower, kind of thinking like a tall version of the Mac Mini that would become the Mac Pro. To me, that feels a little bit too similar to the current form factor, to the trash can. And I don't know that it gains much advantage other than if you add in, like you're talking about, the modularity aspect. And there are a lot of people that have thrown out for years and years, myself included, this idea of doing a Pro machine as various modules that you could sort of swap in and out. And I've always thought of it sort of as there would be some sort of base unit, almost like with slots, or actually it probably works better if each module is independent and then they somehow sort of have a proprietary connector where they can sort of snap together or stack together. So I'm kind of thinking this idea, I like this idea of it's some sort of form factor, and maybe the Mini is the right form factor, where you start out with a base unit and that is the CPU and your basic I/O, or maybe not even I/O, maybe it's just a CPU module, and there's different versions of CPU modules that you can start out with. And then you stack on top of that different I/O modules. So if you're more of a USB person, you can get some sort of configuration that has a lot of USB-C connectors, Lightning connectors, or maybe if you need more Ethernet or whatever it might be. So you have sort of these locking or different kinds of modules. And then maybe you have a GPU module that you pick out your GPU card and what kind do you want there and how high end. And you sort of mix and match these things and they just stack together. And then you, in essence, sort of build a computer. But rather than buying like a case and putting all of that on the inside, what you're doing is you're just stacking these various modules. And I think it's a really cool concept and it's kind of a really cool idea. Yet, I think the issue with it is like in those modules and knowing what configurations are, there's almost like too much customization, I think, is the dilemma that you get into, right? It's like, okay, now we've got to manufacture 3 or 4 CPU modules and we have to do a bunch of different IO modules. So maybe there's 3 or 4 or 5 of those, or, you know, different configurations. And then you have the GPU modules and all of these things, right? And as cool as that sounds, and it'd be neat to mix and match, you have the dilemma of, you know, well, what happens if we sell a ton of the high-end processors, processor modules, CPU-based modules, but no one's really interested in the lower-end ones? And how do you account for that? And how do you know what your supply and demand is going to be? And now you've got to multiply that by X number of different modules. So, you know, which combinations are going to be popular and which ones are not going to be popular? So you get yourself into this little bit of a dilemma. And also, again, I think ultimately the form factor sort of ends up being, in a lot of ways, like the existing trash can module or model. And the dilemma behind that was is that it was sort of limited in terms of expansion. And that's, I think, the number one thing that pros that use that type of machine really objected to. It was sort of like Apple was sort of dictating and mandating what the configuration should be. So, you know, this idea of this modular one is great because it gets away from, you know, you have now infinite sort of options. But I don't know that it gets away from the problem of the sort of form factor of the machine itself. And I don't know that it really addresses what I think pros that are using that kind of machine are really after. And so I still am in the camp where I think what we're looking at is some sort of giant tower sort of box with lots of slots for expansion, lots of room for RAM, lots of options in terms of configurations out of the box, right? So different processors, but then the ability in the future to swap in a different processor or to swap out graphics cards. I really think it needs to be that sort of thing. Now, is the form factor going to be a traditional tower? You know, I kind of think it'd be really cool to see it as maybe a cube, an actual square box, much like a Next Cube, something like that. And I think that could be really interesting from a design perspective, and Apple could do a lot with that. And it still leaves this open amount of sort of space and configuration where you could build it in such a way where you'd have a lot of access, you'd have the ability to do upgrades and put in different cards and configurations and stuff like that. I do think the external whole chassis, GPU, and running stuff off of Thunderbolt 3 is still potentially an option as well in terms of other expansion. But I think really the community has sort of spoken back to Apple and said, look, no, we want a box where everything can be inside one thing, self-contained. We don't want a bunch of wires and things hanging off this thing. We just want to configure it all internally. And we don't care if it's a large case or chassis. It doesn't have to be this tiny, you know, super coolly designed thing. I think you still want the design aesthetic, but I don't think it is going to ultimately be this modular thing. Still, I really like the idea. I mean, the concept to me is very interesting and it's sort of sexy, and I think it could be something that Apple could do and pull off very well, but I'm not entirely convinced that's going to happen. The other part of your argument that I do agree with is I do think that Apple is going to continue to do something with the Mac Mini form factor. Will that change? I think it potentially could, and it could change in some significant ways. There's been people that have talked about almost like a sort of a USB stick style computer. I mean, with solid state RAM and USB-C ports, you can get that thing really pretty tiny. I don't think it's going to be that small where it's going to be, you know, system on a stick sort of thing, but I do think they could go even slimmer and lighter, you know, and it could be very it could be a very interesting form factor, and they could do a lot with that as well. So I'm hoping that they do some sort of redesign on the Mini. I think it's going to stick around. I think Apple knows that it has a certain market. It has a certain kind of customer that prefers that form factor. But I still think that the Mac Pros really want something that's ultimately very, very different from any other thing that Apple creates. Even the iMac Pro, I think that hits a certain customer, but that's not the customer that we're talking about for the traditional Mac Pro. I think they have certain desires and needs, but I could be totally wrong. You could be spot on with your thinking. Like I said, it's an interesting thought. It's one that's been around for a long time. When Apple was doing the blue and whites and the different cheese grater towers, some different concepts came out online. People did renderings and stuff like that, and they were very interesting. But I think ultimately the problem with that is, again, you have to kind of have too many modules and too many variations, and sort of dealing with that from a supply and demand sort of perspective kind of rules that form factor out a little bit, just looking at the business side of things. So that's kind of my two cents on it, and I certainly appreciate you sending in your ideas and thoughts around it, and I encourage anyone else to do that. So if you want to shoot me an email, if you think, you know, Tim is spot on and this is the kind of thing that you'd like to see and you're a pro, let us know about it. If you have a different idea or concept, share your thoughts and ideas. Shoot me an email, maccast@gmail.com. And then last thing I want to talk to you about today, Ethan wrote in to me with a relatively simple question. He said, is it possible to remove system extensions in macOS? And Ethan's kind of old school like me. He remembers the days back when we had system extensions that really needed to be managed. Do you guys remember having to get, I think Norton had a utility for this, and I'm blanking on the name. It was like Suitcase or whatever, right? You would put all of your extensions into various suitcases so you could manage them, because you'd often have extension conflicts. This was back in macOS 8 and macOS 9, and you'd be, you know, big troubleshooting was turn off all of your system extensions that all the third-party apps threw in there and turn them back on one by one until you could find the offending culprit. Luckily, I think, Ethan, those days are kind of behind us, and the short answer that I would give to you is, yeah, we do have kind of the concept of a quote-unquote system extension in macOS, but really these days we don't have to worry about them too much. One of the things, Ethan, I think you were commenting on, hey, I've installed applications over the years. Some of these things have installed system extensions. I really don't know if they're safe to remove, and what ones can I remove, and they're kind of hard to identify. So is there a resource that'll kind of tell me what these extensions are and what they do? And unfortunately, I haven't come across anything sort of like an extension dictionary for macOS 10 or OS 10 or macOS in recent years. But they still do exist. There are these things called kernel extensions. You'll see them as .kext files, K-E-X-T files in your system. And typically where you'll find them is in the root system folder, in the library folder. There's an extensions folder. And I think most of those are the ones that Apple and the operating system installs. I think third-party ones, at least to me, it seems typically those reside in the main, off the root of the hard drive. There's a library extensions folder. That's a different location. Or maybe even in your home folder in the library folder in extensions. If you have some of those, there may be some there. And they're generally really pretty small. So when it comes to like worrying about them taking up a lot of storage on your system, most kernel extensions that I've seen are maybe a few hundred kilobytes to maybe a couple megabytes. So them hanging around, you're really not going to get a lot of space savings. And with OS X Yosemite, as far as, you know, things conflicting and stuff like that, Apple does require that kernel extensions be signed by the developer, and any old ones that existed before they were required to be signed, anything that would be left over from upgrades or something like that, they're probably not even loading. They wouldn't even be allowed to load inside the operating system. So even if you have old ones hanging around, chances are they're not really going to conflict with anything or cause problems. But still, a kernel extension, it actually is, just to explain what it is, it's code that extends the capabilities of the base kernel the main core of the operating system. And generally, they deal with things like I/O, so input, output. So you can think of anything that, you know, might have a display might have kernel extensions, or a USB display, or input devices like a mouse or a keyboard or a trackpad or a trackball or something like that, joystick, gaming controllers and things like that will often, through their drivers, install kernel extension files or KEXT files. And they can occasionally conflict with the kernel code and may cause things like kernel panics. So typically, that's why we say when you start seeing kernel panics, it's generally related to some sort of piece of hardware. So if you've installed a new driver for a new mouse that you've received or a new input device you picked up and you start having kernel panics, oftentimes that can be a sign that that's maybe the culprit of what's causing that problem. So if you want to just identify the active sort of loaded kernel extensions that are in the operating system, there's actually a simple terminal command that you can run. It's kextstat, K-E-X-T stat, and then if you give it the dash L parameter to do a list, it will show you which ones are loaded and currently running. And if you want to actually just filter these down, you can run it through, and this is for really for terminal junkies out there, but I'll have the commands in the show notes at macast.com, but you can also pipe it and run it through a grep command and filter out the com.apple kernel extensions, which means it'll just kind of give you a list of any third-party kernel extensions that are actively loaded. The handy thing about this little command is it will show you the ones that are just actively loaded on your Mac. So even if you have a bunch of leftover ones, you'll be able to see, oh, those aren't even actually loading into the system, and they're just there and benign, and that can maybe help you identify which ones are maybe safe to remove. But I ran this command on my Mac, and I noticed that I only have 8 active kernel extensions running on my system, and most of those were for Parallels, which, you know, is my Windows virtual machine that I run Windows on, and that's so that software can actually access, you know, the input output hardware like mice and keyboards and stuff like that. Duet Display, which lets me connect my iPad as a USB display through the Lightning cable to use as an extra display with my Mac, that has a kernel extension file because, again, it's now an output device, right? It's a display output device. And the Drobo also, I think, has a couple of kernel extension files that get loaded, or at least one. So those kinds of things, you know, that's going to be what's using that. And you shouldn't have too many running on your system. But I really don't know of a single source for looking up the kind of owner application behind a kernel extension. But generally, in looking at the file name, or if you run this this command, it'll kind of show you the what I think is called the domain that it runs in. So it would be, you know, like com.parallels.kxt or whatever I think is the domain for like the Parallels ones. So that quickly identifies, okay, it's Parallels that has installed and is using those. And if I ever remove Parallels, I can probably safely remove any of the ones that are associated with Parallels. So you could go through the directory, you know, after kind of identifying these things, and you can go into those directories and actually manually remove the files. You're probably going to have to authenticate, so with your main admin user account, to actually remove them, but you can get them out of there. I think an even better thing to do, if you have the ability, is to run an uninstaller. If you're removing a piece of software and it offers an uninstaller, run that, because that generally remove things like the kernel extension files. Or you can use something like Clean My Mac, which has a third-party kind of uninstall tool built into it, and it will identify and often remove some of those support and kernel extension files if you're removing some software from your system. So tools like that can be helpful for doing that. But probably the absolute best way to kind of clean out the cruft of old kernel extension files is to just do a clean install when you upgrade your operating system. You know, so if it's been a few years since you've done just a clean install, you know, don't just install over the top. Actually do a clean install of the operating system and then reinstall the applications that you actually use from scratch. And that way you're not going to carry on any of the old maybe extension files that might have existed for applications that you don't use anymore, or devices that you don't have anymore. And that's generally the best way to go. But I mean, at the end of the day, honestly, you probably don't have to worry about kernel extensions too much anywhere more. They're really not a big deal. They don't cause, unless you're having, you know, if you're having a lot of kernel panics suddenly on your machine, then that could be the sign that there's some sort of conflict with maybe some old kernel extension, especially after doing some sort of update or upgrade. But outside of that, I really wouldn't worry about it too much, you know, unless the other reason is you just want to clean things up a bit. But that's kind of my two cents on it. If anybody else has an opinion or a tool or something helpful, and especially if somebody knows of a website that maybe identifies common kernel extension files that might be on your system and helps you identify them, let us know about it. Shoot me an email, maccast@gmail.com. But with that, that is going to do it for the MacCast for this week. Before I leave you, I do want to take a quick moment and thank one of my show sponsors, and that is Smile, makers of Text Expander, PDF Pen, Disk Label, also Text Expander for iPhone and iPad, along with PDF Pen for iOS. You can check out all of their great software and applications. Get more information and details by going to smilesoftware.com/MacCast. Bandwidth for the MacCast is provided by CacheFly. You can find them at cacheFly.com. And all advertising on the MacCast is handled by Backbeat Media. They are at backbeatmedia.com. As always, I love hearing from you, your comments, your emails. If you have a question, something you'd like to hear covered on a future episode of the MacCast, please send me your emails, your audio comments to maccast@gmail.com. You're also welcome to call in on the listener hotline and leave a voicemail. That phone number is 281-622-4269, 281-MAC-IAM-9. If you need show notes with links to anything I talked about on this or any other episode of the MacCast, you'll find those on the website. That's at maccast.com. And while you're there, be sure to check out the forum at forum.maccast.com. And if you want to follow me on social media and just participate in conversation between shows, you can find me on Twitter, twitter.com/MacCast. You can check out the MacCast Facebook page over at facebook.com/TheMacCast. Or you can check out our Google Plus community. That's at google.com/PlusMacCast. That's going to do it for now. Until next time, I will talk to you all again real soon.